time for Yakety Science. Greetings, everyone, and welcome to Yakety Science, the Tulsa Science Show. We are the program that shines a bright but humorous light into all of the darkest corners of the laboratory, the test tube, and the cyclotron. The show that finds the titter in your tectonics, the fun in your forensics, the jest in your genetics, the guffaw in your gastroenterology, the hysterics in your hoo-ha-ology. I am Brian Cross, Associate Professor of Biology at Tulsa Community College, and your humble host. Joining me today, as always, is my co-host, the pinky to my brain, Matt Smith.
Wonderful, wonderful show.
You're supposed to object to my characterization of you as pinky.
I mean, yeah, I should, but I was so caught up in just remembering that I just love the Animaniacs. Yeah. Wonderful.
I was hoping maybe you would ask me, well, what are we going to do?
What are we going to do this episode, Brain?
Same thing we do every episode. All right. Later in the show, we'll be hearing from Dan Ranking and Don Wolf. They are both senior biologists at the Sutton Avian Research Center, so we'll be hearing a bit more about the work that they do there. We'll also be hearing a bit of audio from the Mast Bobwhite Captive Breeding Facility and from the Education Building there at the Sutton Avian Research Center. So something to look forward to later in the show. What's been going on, Matt?
Actually, I'm looking at you and I realize that you're wearing a Lord of the Rings shirt, but also a Thor's hammer.
It is a Thor's
pendant.
Hammer. Yes.
You're kind of mixing and matching mythologies here.
I am mixing and matching. I bought this at the Renaissance Fair last weekend. I bought it to taunt my tennis partner. So I have labeled my racket Mjolnir. And so every time I win at tennis, then I claim that it's because of the power of Thor. And
that's fantastic.
And anyway, I was planning to put this on my racket somehow, right? Affix it to my racket, but until then, I've just been kind of wearing it around to up the nerdiness, right?
Because no,
we
like
all
it.
Felt like there was not enough nerdiness in my life. All right, how about some headlines?
Let's do it.
What's up first, Matt?
Well, first up, we've got people maybe cheating their way up Mount Everest, or at least according to some. So our story starts with a mountaineer, Lucas Furtenbach, who brought a group from London to Mount Everest and managed to scale to the summit and back in less than a week.
And that's a bit shorter than people usually spend on the mountain.
Astoundingly shorter than these expeditions last 60 days. And so much of that time is just sitting on the mountain, waiting for you to acclimate to the altitude, to wait for weather conditions to be right. But these people flew in, up to the summit, back down, a week. How'd they do it?
It was an expeditious expedition. How did they do it, Matt?
They were using xenon gas. And xenon shouldn't do anything chemically because it's inert, but it's a little more complicated than that. So, Brian, what does xenon do biochemically?
The things that have some experimental backing behind them are that it has an anesthetic and analgesic property to it. Also, if you have brain trauma, the neurons can get really excited. Xenon gas can, by binding to certain receptors and nerve cells, can kind of quiet those neurons down and minimize secondary damage that happens. The effect that they're going for here with this is that it stimulates the release of erythropoietin, EPO, and that stimulates the production of red blood cells, and then that ups the oxygen capacity of your blood, which then allows you to function more effectively at high altitudes. It is a shortcut to what those other mountaineers are getting from spending a lot of time at high altitude.
So it's the same process, really.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that where I don't understand what all the hubbub is that this wasn't a short thing. They still had to go through all of the acclimation. Before they went, they spent 10 weeks.
Right. So they spent several weeks sleeping in hypoxic tents to mimic that high altitude environment, those low oxygen levels, to stimulate the production of red blood cells. And then for the last couple of weeks, they went and dosed themselves. They and their xenon pusher, Furtenbach, went to Germany and they dosed themselves with some xenon. But they have confounding variables here, right? So they don't really have any proof that the xenon did anything at all or was really the important factor, the key factor, because they did the other things as well, too. They spent a lot of time hanging out in low oxygen environments, too.
Yeah. The only difference is they didn't do it halfway up the mountain, right. Over halfway up the mountain.
Right.
Well, either way, I'm not doing it.
You're not doing
just to let you know, in case you're trying to do a yakety science sort of expedition.
Well, I mean, that I did have that thought. We should explore this. Mm. You should climb Mount Everest without xenon gas. I should climb it with xenon gas, and we'll see.
And we'll see
if we have a different experience.
Oh, control? No. It needs to be a double blind study.
A double blind study.
So one of us gets the gas, if we don't know who it is.
Yeah, we don't know who it is. Actually, that's going to be two data points. That's not going to be informative, right?
Okay.
We need a sample of
listeners.
TCC faculty, right?
Yeah.
We need to
listeners, you need to. You can volunteer for our study.
Do you know somebody on the IRB? Because we're going to need to.
I don't know. That is human subjects. That's going to take some paperwork.
Right. Well, I guess if we don't want to publish, then it doesn't matter.
Is that the idea?
We're just broadcasting. We're not publishing. We don't need to bother with ethics.
That's the answer.
All right. I think we've done this one to death.
I think we have to. Like all the bodies on Everest.
This topic is dead, much like many of the people who tried to climb Everest. Next up, we have snake venom.
Yum.
That's an odd reaction. You must be related to Tim Freedy. He is one of these guys who is very enthusiastic about venomous snakes, and he keeps lots and lots of very dangerous snakes, including things like the taipan and the crate and the cobra and the mamba.
I think I only recognize maybe two of those names, but sure.
Cobra and mamba, are those the two?
I think those are the ones.
So crate is another one from India, from the Indian subcontinent. And then you've got, in the kind of Australasia area, you have the taipans, which are actually reputed to be the most lethal of all the snakes. He's got all these different species, and he began a while ago either injecting himself or letting the snakes bite him in order to inject small amounts of the venom in order to build up a tolerance to them.
Surely he's injecting himself then. Like he's milking the snake for the venom and then injecting himself a small amount.
So he can modulate the amount. That must be what he's doing. But he has also then subsequently let lots of snakes bite him. And so you can go on YouTube and you can see videos of this guy sort of letting black mambas bite him in the arm.
Why doesn't he just get into like absurd hot sauces like everyone else?
Right. Well, those people have their issues as well too. Who am I to judge? It seems a little strange, but in this case, it may have led to some important science. Jacob Glanville has been interested in the development of vaccines and now of antivenoms that have broad efficacy. We have lots of specific antivenoms that are developed and that are used. If you're bitten by a black mamba, you get the black mamba antivenom. If you're bitten by a king cobra, you get the king cobra antivenom. And so Jacob Glanville, when encountering Tim Freedy, thought, hey, this guy who can be now bitten by all these different snakes and survive, perhaps he has developed antibodies, kind of broad spectrum antibodies. And so what they did was take samples from Tim Freedy, and they used that in the development of antibodies to, cell lines that are going to produce antibodies that they can then test and potentially deploy as kind of a broad spectrum treatment. Now, it's not clear how far they've come here with this. They were able to save lots of, in these animal tests, they were able to save lots of things that had been injected with venom, but I think they were like injecting the venom and then immediately injecting the antivenom. They were using relatively small doses. So obviously, if you're going to expand upon that, you're going to want to inject and then wait, because that's usually how it happens with human beings. And then also, kind of higher doses, more sort of realistic works or not.
And then maybe they could eventually make a like shelf-stable antivenom that you could take with you. If it's a general antivenom, take it with you on your hike and immediately get yourself. It would be like the snake EpiPen.
Right. This is a snake EpiPen. Well, that would be wonderful.
Well, just so you know, I've already copyrighted the term.
You've already copyrighted snake epi?
Snakey pin.
Epi snake?
Yes, the epi snake. Oh, I like that one too.
Snake. There you go. All right. Do we have anything else on this crazy guy?
Self-immunizing with snake venom is generally not recommended.
Yeah, this has this all sort of horrible TikTok challenge sort of
right.
Written over
it. Please don't try to mimic this guy. This guy was
He's done it, so now you don't have to do it.
There
so
we go. That's the real. I am relieved that I don't have to go out there and get bit.
All right.
That was fun.
Up next, we have the answer to our last sound science puzzler. Here it is again, so take a listen. So that cracking sound that you hear is what? It's not the report of a rifle or the blast of a shotgun.
Indeed,
what is it?
No, it sounded like it, though, and it sounded like you're just surrounded by it. But no, but this was back in, what, 2007? The ice storm hit Tulsa.
Right. This is the sound of trees breaking. So when we got up on that icy morning in December of 2007 in Tulsa, you could hear these cracks going off all around you as tree branches succumbed to the extra weight of that ice. Up later in the show, we'll have a brand new sound science puzzler. Before we leave it here, though, I want to do a shout out to some of our previous winners, Randy Ferran, Cody Wallace, Sierra Ross, and Ailish O'Neill. Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Right, this, I, no doubt, is going to be the summit, the Mount Everest of your life, winning the sound science puzzler. Right, you will no doubt treasure that keychain for the rest of your lives. Next up, disappearing science. We like to keep it light here at Yakety Science Laboratories, but the atmosphere surrounding science has been anything but light recently. So we've begun this segment to try to shine a light on some of what is being lost. Most recently, we've seen this assault on Harvard University and an attack on Harvard for supposedly being anti-Semitic or tolerating anti-Semitism or DEI programs that are now verboten. Whatever you think of the merits of any of those charges, the leverage that they're trying to use is science that has nothing to do with any of those things. And so we've seen these efforts to punish Harvard for not cooperating, and that has meant the cancellation of billions of dollars in research grants through the NIH, through the NSF, that have hit Harvard Medical School, have hit the School of Public Health. And so we thought here, rather than highlighting a particular bit of research, that we would just read through the list of different diseases, research grants that have been canceled just recently. So here's the list of diseases affected by these grant cancellations. Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, frontotemporal dementia, tuberculosis, Alzheimer's disease, lung cancer, chlamydia, staph infection, breast cancer, schizophrenia,
opioid use disorder, colorectal cancer, malaria, Parkinson's disease, HIV and AIDS, prostate cancer, alcoholism, rheumatoid arthritis,
insomnia, mitochondrial diseases, epilepsy, influenza, suicide, type 1 diabetes, SIDS, Lyme disease, Merkel cell carcinoma,
HSV-1, nicotine addiction, anthrax, depression, congenital heart defects, lung adenocarcinoma, coronavirus, cystic fibrosis, ovarian cancer, cardiovascular disease,
preterm birth, COPD, genital herpes, cervical cancer, heart disease, obesity, asthma. So that's just a small sample, right? That was just me going through a list of grants that have been canceled for about half an hour or so, looking at the abstracts, looking at the titles. I guess a useful thing to do is to just think about that list and whether you've been affected by it, whether a family member's been affected by it, whether a friend's been affected by it.
And this is just one college amongst the entire nation. Who's trying not to just like turn this into
A rant. Yeah, it's hard for these things not to become rants because so much is being lost. And it's not just like you can turn these grants off and then turn them back on. You have people with specialized training that devote years to developing techniques and developing research
programs.
They're
going to have to go find work somewhere else.
The labs are going to have to close down, and you cannot just turn it back on. And that's on many different timescales. At the longer timescale, you know, both with sort of the persecution of international students and with the canceling of these research programs, we are discouraging people from getting involved in American science. So we are diminishing the population of scientists that we will have 10 years, 20 years, 30 years from now. All right. So on to happier topics.
Totally natural thing in it.
Next up, we have Matt's Chemical Minute, a segment lasting 5 to 7 hours. Matt is going to tell us about an element, a compound, or some other chemical entity that we should care about. He will then give this entity a rating of 1 to 5 stars. I will listen and then potentially argue with Matt about his rating.
Potentially.
Well, we may not argue about this one. Today, because Matt is a slave to Mendelevian order, we have come to the climactic element, carbon, atomic number 6 on the table.
Wonderful element. As always, we're starting with nucleosynthesis because I like to talk about where the elements come from. And so carbon is made in stars. It's only the second element made in stars. Helium is the first element made in stars by mashing hydrogens together. And then we mash helium atoms together in what's called the triple alpha process, which sounds like
impressive.
It sounds like some like fraternity or something like that.
But the triple alpha process got the alpha betas banned from campus, I
think. That's right. But if three alpha particles, or three helium atoms, manage to all collide at once, they can form a carbon atom. Right. It's got
what phase of the star's life cycle does that happen in?
Our star will never really make very much carbon. But for larger stars that enter their red giant phase, especially, are going to be making a lot more carbon and then mashing alpha particles into the carbon to make higher and higher elements.
So when they run out of hydrogen, then they start pushing heliums together to make the bigger stuff.
Yes. Yeah. Carbon is the fourth most abundant element in the universe after hydrogen, then helium, and then oxygen. So yeah, fourth most abundant in the universe, second most abundant in your body. What's your most abundant element, Brian?
Well, probably oxygen.
It's oxygen, yeah. Because we're a bunch of water, aren't we?
Yeah.
We're ugly bags of mostly water. Well, you are.
You're a very handsome bag of water.
Well, thank you very much.
I guess I'm an ugly bag of
water. That's very kind of you. Yeah. Bonding-wise, carbon is the best element ever. It's the first element table that actually obeys the octet rule. The octet rule is a rule we learn in general chemistry about. It pertains to valence bond theory, where you are putting together.
Wait, you're making this too complicated.
Sorry, you're
okay,
right.
Okay, so there's a magic number that atoms like. They like 8 electrons in their valence level. The valence level is the outermost layer. And so if you got 4, then you need to get 4 more so you form 4 bonds.
That was a great simplification of exactly what I expect from biologists, to simplify the beauty of my field.
To simplify and distort. That is our motto.
Yes, simplify and distort. That is so true. So absolutely true. But no. Carbon will make single bonds, double bonds, triple bonds. It will make a variety of different three-dimensional geometries. It is just the coolest, best element. Yeah. So, you want to talk about allotropes of carbon?
I thought you'd never ask.
I did too. So, carbon has a few different forms. Just elemental carbon every time. That's what an allotrope is.
So, it's just carbon, but it's arranged in different ways.
Yes, that's what an allotrope is. It's the same. It's just one element, but it's different forms of that element. Mm-hmm. So, listeners will be familiar with the difference between graphite, which is, you know, your pencil lead, and diamond. Yep. Graphite is a bunch of little sheets of carbon. Kind of all on each other. That's why it's kind of slippery. They kind of slide over each other very much. Yeah. Whereas diamond is a three-dimensional crystal lattice all covalently bonded to each other.
I was reading about kind of how they proved that the diamond was actually carbon, and it was Lavoisier who did it back in the 18th century, and he burned some diamond. And he burned something else that was carbon
some
as
coal
well.
Or something, yeah,
coal or something. And then he measured the amount of CO2 that came out of both. That was how we proved
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Lavoisier, very important guy.
Yeah.
Father of modern of chemistry. That people
died in the French Revolution.
That's sad. Guillotined. Isn't it? Yep.
I suppose that burning diamonds is not the best way to endear yourself to a French mob.
Poor guy. I mean, not poor. He was rich.
Poor
nobility.
In the sense of bad fortune.
But yeah.
You can feel sorry for little Vasier.
I do feel sorry for him. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I can imagine other things you could have learned. I think we can all agree
that the French Revolution went a little bit overboard, with the guillotining, especially of important scientists.
Indeed. So there's graphite, there's diamonds, there's another important allotrope, which are the Fullerenes.
All right.
Now, you may have heard of this, named after
Buckminster Fuller.
That's right. The Buckminster Fullerene is a special fullerene called like the Buckyball.
Right.
Right. The Buckyball is a C60, so it's 60 carbon atoms all arranged in a soccer ball shape, basically. If you go look at a soccer ball, it's all hexagons and pentagons. Mm-hmm. And actually, that is the shape that a Buckminster Fullerene would take. So you can have Buckyballs. You can also have like Bucky tubes where mm-hmm. they form like straws.
And these are all fullerenes.
These are all still fullerenes because it's all just basically a bunch of hexagons of carbon stuck together. And these can be used to do something as mundane as, you know, mix it in with steel to increase its tensile strength by a huge factor. Or you can use them for drug delivery. They basically make little carbon nanotube submarines mm-hmm. so that it can be injected into a patient and survive long enough to, you know, get to the cell or whatever. And sucks. It's a very versatile sort of field.
Right. Yeah. I suppose people most often these days hear the word carbon in the context of what's happening with climate change. But I hasten to add here that it's not just pure carbon. Like all these beautiful things that we're making with pure carbon, the greenhouse gases that we have, the most important ones are carbon dioxide. So you have to mix some oxygen in there to make the carbon.
That's true.
And then methane, which is, you're mixing, of course, the most dastardly of all elements, hydrogen. You're mixing hydrogen in there.
The worst element.
To make methane. My nemesis, hydrogen.
It is indeed. So yeah, and one of the issues with carbon dioxide is that in addition to being a greenhouse gas, it is largely inert.
Right.
It's hard to get carbon dioxide to react with something, which is why photosynthesis is such a great feat. With carbon fixation. Yeah. I know that you biologists have a carbon fixation.
Yes. We do have a carbon fixation, and lucky for everybody, plants have carbon fixation because they pull that carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. They turn it into carbohydrate molecules. So carbon, it's run through. Obviously, we are carbon-based life forms, so it is carbon's at the center of life, of all of our biological macromolecules. You are mostly water, which doesn't have any carbon in it. But then all of the really important bits that make your water different from, make your system different from a non-living thing, it's all the fancy carbon molecules.
It's a wonderful, wonderful element. Are you ready for the rating?
Give it to me.
It's got to be at least 7 stars.
I'm sorry. I'm going to hold the line on this. The scale is going to break down and this is going to become meaningless.
All right. Fine.
We have to respect the integrity of the scale.
Fine. Then 9 stars. Carbon 12 gets 12 stars.
I don't think you understand how this works. Your vote is going to be invalidated, but that's not going to matter because I'm going to give it 5 stars.
Yeah, it's 5 stars.
Yeah, it's got to be 5 stars.
Best element.
Yeah,
best element.
The George Mish Sutton Avian Research Center was founded in 1983 and is located just south of Bartlesville, Oklahoma. Over its 4 decades of existence, the center has made important contributions to our understanding of birds in the state of Oklahoma and also to their conservation. In May, Chad Ellis, the executive director of the Sutton Center, invited me to visit and speak with some of their dedicated professionals and to see some of the important work that they do firsthand.
Coming down.
Okay. Yeah.
You're regular on this.
This looks like a converted old house that maybe was owned by an oil man or somebody at some point.
Yes. Yeah.
So probably somebody named Phillips or something.
Yeah. Price.
Price. Okay. Well. So
Price Tower.
Price Tower. Oh, there you go.
Yeah, it was actually built by a man named Fred Terry and his wife, who was an executive at Phillips back in the day, and then Harold Price later bought it.
Dan Ranking is a senior biologist at the Sutton Center and the person most responsible for the general survey work that the center does and for the publication of the Winter Bird Atlas and Breeding Bird Atlas.
So here's our namesake, George Sutton, who early in his career worked as the Pennsylvania State Ornithologist and spent a whole year living with the Inuit peoples in the Arctic, and has spent considerable time in Mexico, and he was professor emeritus at OU for many years. Well, when you go to the bird range at the museum at OU and you start pulling out drawers of study skins and you start looking at them and you see the nicest looking ones on the tray, and then you check those labels and it's Sutton, 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 Sutton. He was a master at
Taxidermy,
preparing the study skins.
There he is with his shotgun.
Yes.
Preparing to add to the collection.
Ornithology in the previous century was largely done with shotguns more than binoculars as it is now.
That's what I tell my students. You're a good natural historian of the 19th or 20th century. You were just shooting stuff and putting it in boxes.
Well, there's much less of that now, but you know, museum collections that exist now because of that are invaluable for a lot of reasons.
Right, true,
yeah. So these are some of Sutton's Mexican bird paintings here. A lot of prints were made of these four, and he's written a couple books about his work in Mexico. One of them is called At a Bend in a Mexican River. I love this picture of him, too, when he was a teenager. And he's got his arms and his shoulders and everything are full of birds and various critters that he's holding.
Now, are those birds alive? Or
he had numerous pets as a kid.
Can't tell what I'm looking at. Can you tell what they are?
Not really.
Is this like a roadrunner on his shoulder or something?
I think it is, yeah. I think it could be. I think he did have a roadrunner as a kid for a while.
So tell me about what are you seeing? I know the bird populations as a whole are on the decline. Are you seeing particular groups that are declining more than others? What are the patterns that you're seeing as you compare your earlier efforts with the efforts today?
Well, setting aside our own Atlas projects here for a minute, a large North American paper came out a few years ago highlighting bird declines, and they collected data from a whole range of sources to calculate an estimate that there are 2.9 billion fewer birds in North America today than there were 50 years ago.
Yeah, that's just a shocking number. I've heard that.
It is. And among the worst hit are the grassland birds, because much of native grasslands have been converted for
agricultural
production. Yeah. You think of states like Iowa or Indiana or Illinois.
All corn.
that were once all prairie and are now all corn and soybeans.
Yeah.
So, and that continues today, with prairie continue to be converted to agricultural production in South Dakota and other places. And just, you know, routine development as more and more people build more and more houses. And now Oklahoma is somewhat fortunate in that regard, because we still do have a lot of native prairie here. And that makes Oklahoma an important state for conserving grassland birds.
And that's a major focus of the Sutton Center.
That has been a major focus of the Sutton Center, both grassland, tallgrass prairie songbirds, as well as prairie grouse, such as greater and lesser prairie chickens here in Oklahoma. And in terms of the second breeding bird atlas, just only in the last couple of weeks have we finished a first draft. But I mean, just flipping through the maps, there's certainly some really obvious declines in a lot of things.
So you see ranges contracting?
Range contractions, or just overall fewer birds detected in the state. So one species, for example, the loggerhead shrike, was only
butcher birds.
yeah. So named because they have a hooked bill like a hawk or a falcon, but they lack the strong talons of a hawk or a falcon. So they can't hold their prey to tear the meat off of it with their hooked bill. So they impale their prey on things like barbed wire fences and thorns on trees, and use that to anchor the prey, and then they can take their bites off of it. And shrikes have been known from other survey results to be declining over the past several decades, but our results show that they were detected in only 50% of the blocks during the second breeding bird atlas compared to the first breeding bird atlas.
Are you seeing shifts as well, too, like with shifts in climate zone? Are you seeing, you know, population shifting north, or do you see any new birds coming into Oklahoma as a result?
Yeah, that's been the most obvious change is northward extension of ranges of birds from Texas across the Red River into Oklahoma over the past couple of decades. So things like white-winged doves and cave swallows and crested caracaras. We even have some desert southwest birds, like the zone-tailed hawk that now nest in the Wichita Mountains National Wildlife Refuge in Oklahoma.
Okay.
That were typically only found in, you know, southwest Texas and Arizona, New Mexico. We see similar patterns with winter birds as well. The National Audubon Society conducts an annual Christmas bird count every year since 1900. So there's a large data set there to analyze, and they have found shifts in ranges northward by, say, 40 miles over the past several decades.
So the wintering birds are not going as far south.
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. If people want to see this kind of change, I mean, where would be the best place to, I mean, I guess around the Red River, I mean, in the southern part of the state is where you're going to see species that you wouldn't have seen before in the state?
Yes, that's where most of the birds are moving into the state, is the southern portion. And I would encourage people who are interested in birds to make a trip to the southeastern corner of the state and visit the Red Slough Wildlife Management Area.
Yeah, I've been there. It's a really cool area.
South of Idabel. That's a little slice of the Gulf Coast right here in Oklahoma, with alligators and white ibis and occasionally spoonbills and anhingas. And
they promised us alligators when we went down on our trip, but we did not see any.
Yeah, you have to know the spot.
Yeah. Do you know the spot? Can you share the spot with us?
Sure.
With the listeners? They'll all swarm on the alligator spot.
The center consists of several buildings nestled in the Osage Hills and surrounded by Cross Timbers Forest. One of those buildings is the Education Center. Chad Ellis took me inside to meet some of the animals that visit Oklahoma classrooms.
So this is a newly remodeled enclosure that the Lion Foundation and Green Country Home Renovation helped us with. Mm-hmm. But there it is.
Can't see very well. Is it up there in the corner?
Yeah, that's Scout. He's our kestrel.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I can see a vague bird form up there.
You can probably...
Yeah, I can see him. I'm gonna stress him out too much.
He travels with her name is Caitlin Garcia and Daniel Harris, are two of our education outreach folks. And the kestrel is nice because he's small.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So, and these aren't terribly impressive, but these are some of our
chickens.
We used to have turkeys in here, but these are some of the chickens that were the initial incubator. Well, they weren't, but they were used here to initially incubate some of the
fluffy footed chickens.
Yes. So in there, there's a red tail hawk.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, there we go. So we're looking at a big enclosure here with a red-tailed hawk. Nice brown belt across the breast there, on a swing. So he's kind of gently rocking back and forth and looking at us from one side and the other, and the head moving back and forth. He goes out on trips as well, too, on the...
He does, and, you know, the larger the bird, the more challenging they are to manage. And he's both a very large bird and wild. So he was... there was something that happened, I'm not sure what.
Right.
He was sort of brought in. And...
The mass bobwhite is a critically endangered species. The captive breeding facility at the center is one of only two in existence. The second is located in southern Arizona, near the natural habitat of the mass bobwhite.
Oh, sorry.
Okay.
So we're looking at
prepared?
So we have five enclosures here that are each about, what, 3 foot by 6 foot, something like that?
Yeah, maybe a little bigger, maybe four by eight, probably.
4 by 8, something like that. And each of them contains a breeding pair of mass bomb whites. Very cool.
We might be able to duck in a door.
Oh,
yep, and we sanitize one of the rooms as well.
So in the loud noise is the air conditioning unit to cool this, is that right?
Exhaust fans.
And that's the male on the ground and the female up there, is that right?
And they should start laying anytime. Very cool. You can see here we have, it's all, you know, all males. So These aren't paired. This is just sort of bulk housing, general population.
These guys haven't gotten lucky yet, right?
I assume you have similar pens for the females somewhere close by?
Yeah.
Don Wolf, one of the senior biologists at the Sutton Center, is responsible for the captive breeding programs at the center, as well as a multitude of other conservation and research projects.
My name's Don Wolf. Been here going on 41 years. Right. Aside from our first executive director, I was the first staff person and hired on for whatever was needed in summer. They haven't found a reason to get rid of me yet. I've long had an interest, in quail and grouse. From before I ever started working here, I've always been fascinated by prairie chickens. And
I know that you are involved in the bobwhite, is that
well,
right?
Well, I run the Mass Bobwhite Breeding Program here.
Right. And Mass Bobwhite are native to northern Mexico, southern Arizona, is that right?
Northern Sonora and southern Arizona, yes. And they're another critically endangered species. Both Mass Bobwhite and Atwater's prairie chickens would not be here today if it weren't for captive breeding efforts. Right.
They went completely extinct in the wild, didn't they, at one point? Yeah.
They were extirpated from Arizona by early 1900s or by 1900. In Sonora, more than once, they thought they were extinct, but then a population would be rediscovered. Most recently, in 1963, two brothers who were both biologists and quail enthusiasts, birds had not been documented in 6 or 7 years, and these two brothers went and said, you know what, they're not even looking the right places, we'll go down there and we'll find these birds. And they did, they knew what they were doing and they found them. And initially the first captive breeding was done by those two brothers. They ultimately donated their captive flock to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and then the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was able to go capture some more birds and build up that captive flock, which now is literally what we have here.
And so you have a breeding population at Buenos Aires in Arizona, and then you have one here. Yeah, those are the only two?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. What's the total captive population right now?
We have 426 birds right here. Okay. There's probably 700 in captivity right now. Maybe 8. We have, as far as how many are in the wild, we don't know.
Okay. Right now. And are you doing annual releases from the captive population?
Right. Although last year, in 2024, on the refuge that we've been releasing them in Arizona, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service was understaffed and there was staffing changes and stuff, and they put a halt on it. So we did not do any releases last year.
Okay.
But from 2018 through 2023, we've been providing essentially 1,000 birds a year for release.
Right. And so this, I suppose for the Atwaters and for the Mass Bobwhites, you're funded by U.S. Fish and Wildlife grants?
Partially.
All right. And are you concerned that may not continue through,
through this year? We always are, because we've gone through some really mean times in the past, too.
But I know that currently there's a lot of cutting going on.
All I can say is we don't know,
And the lesser prairie chicken has been of great conservation concern, right? It's actually been listed. Is it?
It's been listed.
It's been quite a long drama.
Right. Exactly.
But I understand that the southern population has been listed as endangered and the northern as threatened.
Yes, and that southern population is basically within about 3 counties of New Mexico, 2 counties adjacent, kind of southwest Texas Panhandle. the northern population being extreme northwestern Oklahoma, the northeastern part of the Texas Panhandle, and then the southeast Colorado and western Kansas. So, and that population is, there's still pretty good numbers in Kansas. What mm-hmm. we're seeing in Oklahoma is the population is retracted considerably mm-hmm. and continues to retract. And a lot of that is a number of factors. Woody encroachment, probably, in my opinion, the biggest one, the eastern red cedar, but also other, I mean, that's still the most common one, but it could be other juniper species as well. Okay. I know further south than where the population is now, where right. but 20 years ago, at least 20, 30 years ago, it used to be where it's further south that have been in areas of extreme high oil and gas production, and we whittle away at it. Right. You know, we whittle away at the habitat and then wonder why nothing's there anymore, you know.
So you've got encroachment by eastern red cedars. A lot of that has to do with suppression of fire as well, right? And then the oil and gas development. You've got the barbed wire issue, I know, and the fences.
The fence issue is probably the eastern red cedar and the fence issues are probably by far the greatest factors.
So and the fence strikes. The issue there is that you've got lots of low fencing that the birds can't see, and when they flush, they leave at a low angle and they run straight into the fences.
Yeah.
And that's why you all have a big program to try to get people to mark their fences.
We've done a lot of fence marking. Mm-hmm. Right? In fact, we came up with the methodology. In fact, there's some in the plastic bag right over there.
Okay.
But
so what we have here is like it's a little bit of like siding. Is that right?
It's all the underseal or the trim strips of vinyl house siding.
And those just clip onto the fences, and that allows the bird to see it. What about the just to wrap up the ptarmigan study?
I studied ptarmigan in New Mexico for 12 years.
Right. And this is in alpine tundra at the tops of mountains. Yeah.
Very tops of mountains. And mostly because climate change is hitting the mountains hard. And those birds are a cold-adapted species. They also snow burrow in the winter, and there's less snowpack. Mm-hmm. The climate change is already affecting willows, which are their food source throughout the winter, through 9 months out of the year. And so that species is virtually gone from New Mexico now. Mm-hmm. It's still that is declining in Colorado, but species-wise, it's not in trouble. It's that those southern populations,
yeah. Right. So that's part of population shifting north as a result of climate change. They're,
So,
all right. I appreciate your time.
Ειρενικός προσφύλος ελελήθ.
Next up, we have our new sound science puzzler. In this segment, I will challenge you to identify a science-related sound. It could be the sounds made by an animal, a physical phenomenon, or it could be something that is associated with science in some way. Here is your new sound science puzzler. Okay, that's it. Now you may recognize that sound, but what is it? Do you know what you're listening to? You know what's making all of that racket? And so let's have it one more time. All right, that is it. If you think you know the answer, send it to yakityscience@gmail.com. Be sure to include your name, a good contact number, your social security number, your mother's maiden name, and your date of birth, right? All of those are required.
That's how we get our funding.
That's exactly right. We will reveal the answer to this puzzler on the next episode of Yakety Science. That's it for this episode of Yakety Science. As always, we leave you with a wise, wise quote from a scientist of note. This week's quote comes from...
Hold on. No, after last week's dour quote, I think your quote probably is our being revoked.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
so you have something ready for us?
I have a quote. Here we go. This week's quote comes from Lise Meitner, who is an Austrian-Swedish nuclear physicist instrumental in the discovery of nuclear fission. She said, "Science makes people reach selflessly for truth and objectivity. It teaches people to accept reality with wonder and admiration, not to mention the deep awe and joy that the natural order of things brings to the true scientist." Now, with those humbling words, we leave you, dear listeners, until the next episode of Yakety Science. Thanks for joining us.
See you next time.
Yakety Science is produced, written, and edited by Matt Smith and Brian Cross. Production help provided by Scott Gregory. Theme music by Lobo Loco. Yakety Science is recorded at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa and at the Center for Creativity at Tulsa Community College. If you'd like to yak back at us, our email is yakettyscience@gmail.com. We love to hear from you. Lots of good dad jokes there. I didn't know you had children.
I have fur babies.
You have fur babies. Okay, mm-hmm. That counts.
You have children, right? Or instead of fur babies, do you call them skin puppies?
No, I can honestly say that I have never called them skin puppies.